Welcome to AUSA's Army Matters podcast. This is Thought Leaders with Joe Craig. My guest today is Ty Sedgley, author of Robert E. Lee and Me, A Southerner's Reckoning with the Myth of the Lost Cause. Ty Sedgley is professor emeritus of history at West Point, where he taught for 2 decades. He served in the U.S. Army for 36 years, retiring as a brigadier general. He's the Chamberlain Fellow at Hamilton College, as well as a New America Fellow. General Sedgley has published numerous books, articles, and videos on military history, including the award-winning West Point History of the Civil War. He graduated from Washington and Lee University, and he holds a PhD from The Ohio State University. Ty, welcome to the podcast.
Joe, great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Excellent. I want to get started talking about the book, which examines the legacy of the Civil War and the Confederacy, but the book's much more than a straightforward history. It's a very personal account as well. So let's start with your own history. Can you tell us what Robert E. Lee meant to you growing up in the South?
Yeah, I grew up born in Virginia outside D.C., and I grew up revering Robert E. Lee. And I guess you could say that on a scale of 1 to 10, I would rate Lee an 11. And despite the fact that I went to church every Sunday, I would have put Jesus at about a 5. So Lee was not only the greatest soldier that ever lived, I grew up believing he was the greatest man who ever lived. And everything about my upbringing contributed to that. So my first chapter book was Meet Robert E. Lee. And I read that over and over again. And it said that Lee was the greatest human that ever lived. And growing up in Alexandria, Virginia, more things were named after Lee than any other city in Virginia, twice as many. And then I looked at the statues that I grew up around. They were all about the Confederates. If I looked at the school I went to, so I went to Douglas MacArthur Elementary School through the 5th grade until I was bused across town to the segregated school in Alexandria. And what was the name of the segregated black school in Alexandria? Robert E. Lee Elementary School. So my entire life led me to revere Lee and the Confederates as honorable people who lost with dignity. And that idea of growing up that way actually is quite pernicious that I grew up that way, because it enforced a way of thinking about Lee that he was honorable despite the fact that he went against the United States. But Alexandria and the entire state of Virginia looked at Lee as the epitome of who a young person should be. And in fact, that's what I wanted to be, was an educated Christian gentleman, just like my hero, Robert E. Lee.
Well, that desire certainly carried through after your boyhood years when you entered college and you joined ROTC at Washington and Lee University. Why in the book do you refer to that as the Shrine of the Lost Cause?
Well, yeah. So Washington Lee was Washington College until Lee died in 1870, and then it was renamed Washington and Lee. And it became the site of sort of the shrine where Lee was worshipped. So if you go into the chapel there at Lee Chapel, there is an apse of the church, the sanctuary, which for Christians is where the Holy of Holies are, where the altar is. And the altar in Lee Chapel is not a normal altar that you would see in a church, but rather it's a slab of white marble. And on top of the white marble lies a statue of Lee in Confederate uniform asleep on the battlefield, ready to rise up to support his people, the white people of the South, fighting against not only the North, but fighting for slavery, fighting for white supremacy. And through a series of speeches there that I chronicle in the book, you can see where Lee is literally worshiped. So the Lost Cause, the worship of Lee, becomes a civic religion among white Southerners, which not only starts in Virginia, but spreads then throughout the South. And by the mid-20th century is actually believed by almost all white Americans that Lee is this great hero to all Americans. In fact, Roosevelt does a speech in 1936, Franklin Roosevelt, that says that Lee is the greatest of all gentlemen. And certainly when I first went there, that's what we got. We went to General Lee's college, and he was worshiped in a way that was a religious, passionate worship. And that's what I got at Washington Lee. That's why I went there, because I knew that I wanted to be an educated gentleman like my hero, George Washington, like my hero, Robert E. Lee. And that's what I got while I was attending, as we called it, General Bob's College.
Certainly after that experience, after your education there, you were in ROTC, so you received your commission, and then you launched into a 36-year-long Army career. Over that time, you came across a lot of memorials to the Confederacy, and we'll talk about bases in a bit, but like many others at the time, you didn't pay them a lot of attention. So what was the turning point eventually that led you to reexamine your history and the Confederate history?
Well, I think the first thing was I took my oath of commission at Washington and Lee. I have a picture of me next to the portrait of Lee and Confederate Gray. Then I went and got my commission surrounded by Confederate flags and raised my right hand and said the oath. And by the way, that oath was first written in 1862 as an anti-Confederate oath to ferret out traitors, secessionists. And so I took an anti-Confederate oath surrounded by Confederate flags. So in the Army, I went to all the bases, that the posts that are named after Confederates. But what changed me was when I was at West Point. And as I was there, I noticed I lived on Lee Road by Lee Gate in Lee housing area. And I saw this sort of sign that said Lee Barracks, our highest honors to name the barracks. I walked by Pershing Barracks, Eisenhower Barracks, Grant Barracks, and stopped at this sign for Lee. And that's basically when I went, oh my gosh, why are there more things named after Robert E. Lee at West Point than at Washington and Lee? So I went to the archives and I started trying to understand why there were so many things named after Lee at West Point and then in the Army. And the history changed me. The facts changed me. The evidence changed me. Once I started realizing this, started understanding why the Confederates fought. They fought to create a slave republic, that they committed treason, that they fought against their country to destroy the United States. And why did they try to destroy the United States? To create a country based on enslavement of Black Americans in perpetuity. And once I sort of got the history down, I was so shocked and appalled by this, I had to start telling people. And that process of the facts and then starting to write about it, it changed me and put me on the path I am now.
Well, one of the things you mentioned is even after this research that you did and a lot of discussions that you have with people who were kind of raised in the Lost Cause mythology, you run into a lot of resistance, even to evidence-based arguments. And it seems like a lot of that resistance could be coming from the language that's used to describe the Civil War that we grow up with. Using the war between the states instead of the Civil War is, you know, is a well-known example. But one that really struck me was the Union Army. Would you explain to our listeners why that's actually an inaccurate term?
We call it the Union and the Confederate, the rebels and the Yanks. And by doing that, we make them equal, and they're not equal. The Union Army, when we say the Union Army, it makes it seem as though it's an army that fought only one war in its history, and then it was relegated to the dustbin of history. There's only one war that the Union Army fought in, and that's in the Civil War. When in reality, it's not the Union Army, it's the U.S. Army. It's the same army that I served in, the same army that so many of us served in. And they were wearing the same blue coat with the same U.S. on their shoulders, the same shoulder boards that I wore in my career. So it's not the Union Army, it's the United States Army. And the soldiers that fought for them were U.S. Army soldiers. The soldiers that Confederates killed were U.S. Army soldiers. So in fact, if we think about it, Lee and his comrades, particularly Lee killed more U.S. Army soldiers than any other enemy general. They're the enemy against the United States. And they certainly knew this during the Civil War. They knew it right after it. They were traitors for slavery, and they killed U.S. Army soldiers. And it's the same with what we call the war. The war between the states comes in the 1890s when Southerners are trying to come to grips with what they had. By saying the war between the states, they make it two equal sides. Civil War is not equal. It means that there is one person that was right, or you could call it the official name, the War of the Rebellion. And that's what's on the statue at West Point. It says the War of the Rebellion. And that's what I like to call it, or what Frederick Douglass called it, which is the Slaveholder's Rebellion. And the idea of rebellion, secession, insurrectionist is what we need to call it. And when we use that language, U.S. Army, the Civil War, it means a certain thing. When we use the war between the states or the war of Northern aggression, it's giving the Confederates something that they shouldn't have, which is they should not be given the idea that what they did was right. What they did was wrong.
Well, certainly the U.S. Army and Congress and West Point in the years following the Civil War knew that the Confederacy, the rebellion was wrong, and they had a very strong anti-Confederate sentiment for a long time. And as you mentioned, that's reflected in the oath and in the motto. When did that start to change? When did the attitude start to soften?
So, yeah, from 1861 up until, say, 1898, there was a clear delineation that these were traitors. And throughout West Point, so if you think of for West Point, almost all the major monuments are anti-Confederate up to 1898. And even 1898, the duty honor country is anti-Confederate. No Confederates in the cemetery. It changes with the Spanish-American War. And what happens is that there's this common foe, and they want to bring America back together, bring Billy Yank and Johnny Reb back together again. And what that will do is to fight that common enemy. But of course, part of what they're doing is this reconciliation movement that starts in 1898 is done at the expense of Black America. And so that's the same time that lynching starts reaching its peak, when Confederate memorialization, Confederate monuments reach their peak, all happen at the same time. So white America comes back together and agrees to disenfranchise violently Black America. And that's what we have to realize. That's when the Confederates come back. It's a reaction against integration. It's a sign of white supremacy. And that happens in 1898 with the Spanish-American War. It happens again in 1917 in World War I, and even again in World War II, is these competing visions, which is white America coming back together. And that's when we see Confederate memorialization and the army coming is really starting in World War I. And so that idea of bringing America back together, but only white America, and putting the heel, the boot, creating an apartheid police state in the South and in the army, it happens in that early part of the 20th century.
Now it seems like a good time to bring in the question about army bases. As the U.S. Army start to incorporate and heal some wounds in their mind in World War I and following, how did these base names start getting changed? And can you give us a few examples of how that process went?
Right. So we have about 10 base names named after Confederates. And they were named in two periods, World War I and World War II. And who we named them after? John Brown Gordon, never fought in the U.S. Army, led the KKK in Georgia, gave a speech to Black Charlestonians in South Carolina saying that if you demand equality, this is in 1868, if you demand equality, we will start a race war and our 40 million will exterminate you 3 million. Benning never served in the U.S. Army. Bragg was a terrible general and was a large enslaver. Polk, also a terrible person, terrible general. But we named them World War I and World War II, and two things to remember. The first is that the Army was a white supremacist organization. Pershing said in World War I, don't talk to Black soldiers. Don't tell them they're doing well. We must separate and segregate them as much as possible, and gave one division to the French, the only division he gave to the French. In the interwar period during 1930s, the Army War College, which was sort of the planners of that period, actually wrote that, quote, Black soldiers couldn't fight because they weren't human. They weren't the same race as whites. And so they named it World War I and World War II, both because the Army is a white supremacist organization. And the second one is to make white Southerners, particularly white political Southerners, happy. And that occurred in, like Fort Benning, Fort Gordon, all of them were meant to appease white Southerners, who were the only ones that had political power. Remember, the South was a racial police state during this period. And so it named these during World War I and World War II to appease white Southerners because the Army is a segregated organization, because it's a white supremacist organization, and because we think of the Confederates as being just as good as the same as Union or as U.S. Army officers.
Wow. So turning now to Robert E. Lee himself, you know, subject of the book, I, for one, had always for long thought that his decision to leave the Army to fight for his state was a common one. You discovered in your reexaminations that that was not the case. Would you share that information with our listeners?
Sure. Growing up, I thought that Lee, as one of his biographers, Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer, said it was the decision he was born to make. And I argue, first of all, no, he chose treason. And my argument is that there were 8 U.S. Army colonels from Virginia. By the time Virginia seceded in May 23rd, 1861, there were 8 U.S. Army colonels from Virginia. 7 of those colonels choose to stay with the United States, including a general like Winfield Scott, another Virginian, who said, it is my duty to suppress insurrection, my duty. And another colonel from Virginia said, I owe my state little, my country much. So Lee chose treason, chose to fight against his country, even though many of his family members stayed with the Union. And he was one of the first to go with the Confederacy, despite many of his family members thinking that he would not. In fact, he said when his family gathered, you may think that I have done wrong. Now, why did he do it? I think he did it because of his dying belief in his human enslavement. By 1861, he was the largest holder of enslaved people in the U.S. Army. He made his fortune off of it, and he was a cruel enslaver of people, ordering them whipped. Unlike his father-in-law, he broke families apart to make sure that he earned more money. And his father-in-law at Arlington, this is at Arlington, kept families together, allowed enslaved people to be married. Not Lee. Lee did not do that. He broke these families apart, sold them apart. And he was a believer of enslavement, which he says several times during the war that he is. He rails against the Emancipation Proclamation, saying that it will destroy our social system. By that, he means slavery. So I argue that Lee chose treason when he didn't have to and should not have to create a slave republic because he believed so thoroughly in human enslavement.
In addition to supporting slavery, could ambition have been a factor in that? I mean, you note in the book that he accepted that promotion to colonel when he was the only one of eight who left the army to join the rebellion. He accepted that promotion 3 weeks before quitting.
Yes, he selected a promotion to colonel, which, by the way, the first West Point graduate to become a brigadier had only occurred in 1860, and that was not a line. That was sort of the quartermaster type. So he accepted the promotion to colonel, and with it, commander of the 1st Cavalry Regiment, which is still on active duty today, a very storied regiment. He accepted that during that time. And by the way, for the last 2 years, he had not been with his old regiment, the 2nd Regiment, on the Texas frontier. He had been at Arlington serving as an enslaver managing these plantations. So for nearly 2.5 years, he had been at Arlington. So I think he thought more like slaveholders than army officers. I mean, he had to take an oath 3 weeks before he resigned, and he was offered command of the entire U.S. Army by Winfield Scott, the great Virginia commander, and he refused that, even though many other people did not. So, yeah, I keep coming back to this idea that Lee chose treason, and he chose it, not necessarily because of his ambition, though he was very ambitious, but he could have had that in the U.S. Army, too. His ambition really was his underlying belief in a social system based on slavery. And that slavery is what drove him to the decision to turn his back on the United States of America. And that's why the fact that we now to this day have so many statues to him, to someone who chose slavery, who turned his back on the United States of America, is appalling to me as an American soldier.
How do you respond to those who say, well, he had these terrible attitudes about slavery, maybe he chose the wrong side, but what about his battlefield success? Isn't that reason enough to admire him?
Well, no. The idea would be that he was a great commander. And I will say that certainly he was the finest commander in gray. And I'm not trying to say that he was a terrible commander that way. He was a bloody commander. He had a higher casualty rate than did Grant. But I think that the fact that he fought so well for so long for such a terrible cause caused more people to die on both sides because of that. But in the United States Army, we don't say that just because a person is competent in his job, that he has the character to be honored. So we can study Lee and study his great Chancellorsville campaign, but we should also understand that he was a terrible failure at Gettysburg. I grew up believing that he showed nobility and defeat at Gettysburg, but in the end, he lost. And we Americans like winners, and we should instead praise the greatest commander of that war, Ulysses S. Grant. So Grant was the great commander. It was Grant who understood why this war was so important. And it was Grant who used formerly enslaved people into his army. Remember that Lee had zero black Confederate soldiers. He used enslaved labor. Also, when he went north for the Gettysburg campaign, his army kidnapped free black people and escaped slaves for sale back in Virginia. After the Battle of the Crater, his soldiers slaughtered black POWs committing war crimes. So we've got to look at him in total, and don't be seduced by the smell of gunpowder, which I did for years. Don't look at the battlefield success, because that takes our focus away from the purpose of the war and what Lee fought for. And Lee fought to create a slave republic and destroy the United States of America.
Well, finally, to wrap up, what do you say to those who think that removing monuments or changing names at this point is changing history?
Well, two things. One, we always are changing history. Our history is based on the present, on what we think about. Remember that it was a change in history to put those monuments up. The change was that in the 19th century, the U.S. Army believed that Lee was a traitor and would never have honored him. The change comes, at least for the Army, in World War I through World War II, and even later when we continue to revere Lee. In fact, at West Point, we have monuments put up to him as late as 2001, 2002. So for me, that changed history. So what we're trying to do now, at least for me, is look at the evidence and come up with a better understanding. It's not going to change history. What's going to change is who we honor. And Fort Lee, Virginia, is home to the most diverse workforce in the country. Our logisticians, the finest logisticians in the history of the world, are 50% African-American and a minority white. And yet their home base is named after someone who fought so long, so well, and so hard to keep Black people enslaved forever. And I think that the United States Army should be better than that. We are better than that. I love the Army. I dedicated my life to the defense of this country. But I want to honor real heroes, the heroes who we should honor. And those are people like Vernon Baker, a Black lieutenant who received the Medal of Honor in World War I. It's a guy named Reuben, who was a Holocaust survivor. And that Holocaust survivor then received the Medal of Honor, not only for wiping out a North Korean platoon and saving the rest of his platoon, but then in the prisoner of war camp, saved his fellow soldiers by getting them food. Think about who we can honor that represents the values of the United States Army, who fought and died for this country, not for a country that tried to destroy the country that we fight so hard to preserve. So I think it's an amazing opportunity that the Army has to rename these posts after true American heroes.
Well, that looks very promising for the future. And thank you, Ty, for being our guest today. And I want to remind listeners that his new book is Robert E. Lee and Me, A Southerner's Reckoning with the Myth of the Lost Cause. Thanks again, Ty.
To all our listeners, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. The Army Matters podcast series is brought to you by the Association of the United States Army, the U.S. Army's professional association, member-supported, Army-connected. Visit us at AUSA.org for more information or to become a member. Your membership helps AUSA continue to carry out its mission to educate, inform, and connect with the total Army, our industry partners, and our supporters of a strong national defense. For questions or to provide topic recommendations, email us at podcast@AUSA.org. Have a great Army Day. Hooah.